Thank you. My name is Tom Needham. I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank you for inviting me and the hospitality with Einar and his family today and earlier at breakfast. It's good to be in Copenhagen. This is the second time I've been in Copenhagen. I was here about 5 years back on business. I didn't realize that there were... Well, maybe back 5 years ago, the path that we're on now in our big book, it wasn't relevant back then. But I'm glad to hear that and see that today. I usually share, and this is a similar format to our meeting. My home group is the Away Out Group, and it's on Staten Island in New York. And we are a big book-based meeting. We share about recovery. In fact, the prerequisite of our meeting is that you've had to go through the steps as outlined in our big book, begun making amends and are living in 10, 11, and 12. And before you can even speak at our meeting, because it's recovery-based, and that's a group conscience, and we want to make sure the solution is being conveyed to the people that need to hear the solution. And that's what we're talking about in Real Alcoholics, because unfortunately I suffered from alcoholism for a lot of years in and out of the fellowship. I'll get into my story a little backwards. I know I share what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. And In October of 1994, I found myself again in a jail cell in Brooklyn, New York, and in that place, I was. It came to me in that jail cell that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work for me. And from where I was sitting, it made some sense, because I was introduced to the Fellowship of AA back in 1974. So 20 years elapsed. And I had a period of sobriety where I was separated from alcohol. By the way, God separated me from alcohol on October the 15th, 1994. But in that place... I looked back at being in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a period of 2 decades, 20 years. I knew somewhere inside of me that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work the way I perceived Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. And I perceived Alcoholics Anonymous from the people, you know, and the fellowship. And we have our triangle. Okay, and we have three sides of that triangle. Okay, and I was only living in one side of that triangle, expecting through osmosis the other two to show up, and it never happened for me. What showed up for me was alcohol. Okay, because I didn't take any action. I didn't take any action in this book. Although I tried, you know, I tried. I just didn't know. My friend Joe talks about, for an awful long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was suffering from a part of the disease I didn't even know I had, you know. And that for me was, you know, like this thing called the spiritual malady. And I found out later on that it was the spiritual malady. You know, there's a promise in our book. It talks about once the spiritual malady is overcome, the mental and the physical straighten out. Okay. But I didn't know that. I didn't know what I was suffering from, you know. Like I said, I was introduced to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1974. In our third tradition, it says that the only requirement for membership to Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. Well, back in 1974, I didn't even have that. But my wife had a desire for me to have a desire to stop drinking. You know? So she dragged me off to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And that's because 3 months prior to that, I guess it was in about March of 1974, we were only married about 3 months. We got married in January the 74, so we're coming up on our 30th anniversary. So you know that this woman suffered from untreated alcohol Al-Anonism for an awful long time, you know, to stick with a guy like me, you know. But the book says, you know, we sometimes get the best women, you know, and that's been, I guess that was my experience. 3 months before she was up in our apartment in the middle of the night. And back in New York, they were having public service announcements for Al-Anon. And there was a TV, public service announcements on TV. And I was obviously away on one of my escapades for about 2 or 3 days. And she was watching and always fearful, you know, of what was going to show up when I walked in the door, because I was always a surprise. I was always a surprise. She didn't know, you know. But I carried a lot of baggage in with me because I was not a nice person, you know. You separated me from alcohol, which was my solution at the time. You know, I am not a nice person. I must have my alcohol, you know, to be at one with this world, okay? And that was the only solution I ever had. And by the way, it was the only solution that I ever had. 20 years around this fellowship, only I didn't know it, you know? I didn't know that, you know? So she was, she saw this commercial and, you know, like, and she was moved to go to Al-Anon. And, she's been with Al-Anon ever since. But I caused a lot of harm. What moved her to go was a lot of fear, terror, and horror. Because she had the idea, we were together for about a couple of years up to that point. We were only married about 3 months. But she had the idea, I guess like any Al-Anon, that, you know, she was going to change me. She was going to fix me. Okay? And that wasn't the case, you know. And I couldn't even fix me. Nobody knew who could fix me, you know. And she dragged me off to that, you know, like first meeting, and out in the Bay Ridge Group in Brooklyn, New York, in about June or so of 74. And I showed up at that meeting, and a pretty heavy set fella comes running up, and he said, Ned, well, my nickname was Ned in the old days, and this guy knew me, you know. And he shows running up, he says, I'm glad you're here. You're in the right place. And I didn't want to see him. And I didn't want to hear what he was saying, especially when my wife was sitting next to me. You know, I just wanted, you know, I'm putting a Band-Aid on this thing, and let me get out of here and drink. Go ahead, I want to do it. I'll set us. But, and that man happened to be my bartender. One of my bartenders, you know. And Johnny H., he's still sober today. So he must have well over 30 years of sobriety in this deal. And I went to another meeting shortly after that. I guess some sort of, I don't remember anything, what happened with that meeting. I guess some sort of seed may have been planted. I went to another meeting shortly after that, like I said, and I got a little scared, you know. Because maybe they were talking a little too much truth, you know? And the agnostic that I was, you know, I didn't think anything could work for me, even way back then. And I didn't use the word agnostic because I didn't even know what it meant by then. But from where I was coming from, that was my thought process, you know? And so I continued to drink, and we suffer from a threefold disease. And it's progressive in its nature in each part of those, you know, aspect of that disease, in physical, mental, and spiritual. And I continued causing more harm, you know. And I was a violent drunk. You know, when we're in inventory, and it talks about, you know, like, you know, those six or seven areas of our life where it's hurt, threatened, or interfered with, you know, and when we're doing inventory, and you hurt, threaten, or interfere with my alcohol, you know, we have a problem. We have a major problem, and I'll do anything to get to that alcohol. I don't care what, okay? And I caused a lot of harm in that process, you know, doing that, you know. But at the same time, I really had no choice in the matter either. I had no choice. I must drink, you know. I cannot not drink, okay? My wife was, Ginny was constantly bringing all kinds of people over to the home, and and I'd be coming off a drunk, and I'd be crawling up the stairs to our home, and these people would just, you know, and I knew that they would be in the living room, and I'm just trying to get into the bedroom, you know, and just crash, you know, and all of the friends from Al-Anon, you know. I used to call them the Sisters of Perpetual Revenge, you know. And they're all talking about me. They're all trying to get me. In 1978, as I mentioned, you know, things were getting worse. I ended up in a few more jail cells, and I remember sitting across the street from the 7-2 prison in Brooklyn, and it was 77, about this time of the year in October, and I remember seriously considering to take myself off of the planet, you know. And at the time I had two little girls and my wife. And I started to experience some truth within ourselves. And we always experience some truth. And I believe what a man said, I don't know if you ever hear him much out here, if you have any of his tapes, he's dead and gone, you know, I guess to that big meeting. His name is Chuck Chamberlain. And he talks about what you came here looking for, you came here looking with, you know. And it's always deep down inside, and I just need to get unblocked, you know. But I guess I was experiencing some truth there. And my truth was, as they say in the doctor's opinion, you know, rather than continue to fight, you know, some make the supreme sacrifice. And I had that serious consideration, but at the same time I was, I guess I was a coward, you know. So, you know, like that was the second time. What's about that? So I was, I guess what my other friend Mark says, you know, we're a failure at living and we're a failure at dying, you know. And, so I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I showed up there, and I had a half a load on in a meeting in a group called the Sunset Group in Brooklyn. And I remember a man showing up and welcoming me at that meeting. You know? And he knew I was half drunk, and he didn't care, you know. He says, just as long as you don't, you know, disrupt the meeting, you're welcome, okay? He says, if you have to drink, come on, you know, come on anyway. And I believe that even today, you know, because even Ebby, you know, showed up at Bill's house in Clinton Street in Brooklyn, and Bill had a half a load on, and he got the message. He got the message, you know. He got drunk again, but he got the message, you know, because he saw his buddy there, you know, and something happened to him. So I took that at heart, what that man said, and every Tuesday and Friday night I'd show up at that meeting, and I had my flask of Johnny Walker Red with me. And I'd be slipping into the bathroom, you know, and out of my arrogance, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous being the sacred place it was, I didn't understand that. And I'd be sharing on steps and, you know, very sick man, you know. And the time came that I, at the end of 3 months, what happened was, is again, I'm showing up at these meetings, and I'm experiencing truth, and I'm in spite of myself, you know, and it's getting worse and worse and worse, you know. Now it's not even a place for me to drink so I could just get to that place of ease and comfort that it talks about in the doctor's opinion. Now I'm drinking to get into oblivion because I'm seeing truth about myself and I can't stand looking at myself or seeing the truth about how I feel about myself, you know, and what I am, you know. And I don't know what to do, you know. And in March of 78, I don't know what happened. You know, I just showed up at a meeting and God separated me, you know, from alcohol. And for the first, you know, like few years, you know, I did what you people told me to do. You know, they said, don't drink and go to meetings and 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, I can do this, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had two meetings every weekday and three meetings every weekend day, and I did it for about 2 or 3 years straight. But our book doesn't talk about that. Our book talks about, because I had a family, and by this time my boy, Tommy, came around, and he was conceived after my 90th day. I thought that was sort of a spiritual experience or something like that, you know, that I would have a boy, you know. And my son came into our lives, and but I was never home. I was never home. It was still all about me and the fellowship. And this went on. And then after about a couple of 3 years, things started to get really, really, I'm restless and I'm irritable and I'm discontented, you know. I'm never satisfied with life and I don't understand what's going on inside of me, you know. And I don't see it as a problem because everybody else around me are in the fellowship are pretty much experiencing the same thing from the way I looked at it. So other things became important after 3 years. Money. We were talking today with Einar, you know, he was talking about the big deal, you know, I mean, money, that's, you know. So now I'm climbing up this corporate ladder and I am, you know, money's going to make me happy. Stature is going to make me happy, you know. And, you know, my own business is going to make me happy, you know. And I got all that. And that didn't happen, you know. I mean, I'm still restless. So what happened, you know. Another woman is an upstanding member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a wife, three children at home. Another woman is going to make me happy, okay. And then after that, that didn't do it. Fix me for a little bit. For a little bit, you know. And then gambling came into my life. And that's going to make me happy, you know. You know, I don't know if you know, Brooklyn is about 90 miles away, you know, from about a two-hour trip from Atlantic City in New Jersey. And before they had ATM cards, you know, where you can go to a bank and get cash. I made two trips down to Atlantic City in one day. I had to come back and get money, go back down there again, you know, because I'm suffering, you know, and it was the action on the tables, you know, the juice, something to fill me up, you know. And then my wife dragged me off to Gamblers Anonymous, you know. She didn't know. Now I go out to, we go out to Vegas, now I'm pulling her away from the slot machines. I said, come on, let's see a show, you know. I gamble, I don't have a problem with gambling. That wasn't my problem. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And one day, I identify so well with a man by the name of Fred in our book. And he talks about there wasn't a cloud on the horizon. There wasn't a cloud on the horizon, you know. And I had my big town car, and I had my own business. And it was 1987, and I'm on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, you know. I'm the big deal. I'm in six figures. I'm doing well from all outside appearances, you know. And I got up out of that town car, separated from alcohol nearly 10 years, and I walked into a bodega or, as you may know it, or a deli out there, and I grabbed two cores, you know, the mental blank spot, just showed up. That morning, I didn't even think about having a drink. I didn't even think of it, okay? But I just got up, and I went in, you know? The delusion that I'm like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed, and that has to do with a lot of things in our with the spiritual malady. but it especially has to do with alcohol. Okay, I am not like other people. Okay, and it got progressively worse for the next 7 years, and I tried to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't. I couldn't make it. We have a saying in the fellowship on Staten Island and other places in the United States. They say meeting makers make it. Mm-hmm. I'm not discounting meetings. Meetings are important. But I was going to 5 meetings, 6 meetings a week. I had a desire to stop drinking at this point. It was getting bad, you know. And I couldn't stay stopped. You know, I'd walk out of the meeting. I remember I'm in morning meeting and I slam my fist on the table. And I'm so angry at them, and I say, you know, all I'm doing is coming here and I'm putting a damn Band-Aid on this thing. I'm just putting a Band-Aid on it because I know I'm going to leave here and I know I'm going to drink. I know it, you know. I don't want to drink, but I know I'm going to drink. I had no choice. And then people show up to me after the meeting, like an old-timer there. I don't know, maybe he was a hard drinker, just hanging around in delusion for 20 or 30 years. I don't know. But he shows up with me and he says, Tom, you know what to do. You were sober nearly 10 years. If I knew what to do, wouldn't I be doing it? You know? And I didn't know. And and that brought me up to, that was only a few months prior to that last jail cell that I was in, because this time I was facing about a year at Rikers Island, which isn't a pretty place. I don't know if anybody's heard of in New York. But I was 46 years of age at the time, and I know a guy like me isn't going to make it up there for a year, you know. And in that jail cell, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I just knew Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work for me. It just didn't work for me. And it was sort of like I was driven to my knees in that jail cell, and it was a cry for help. I don't even remember the prayer. There's a guy what we were talking about earlier, Peter and I, my friend Peter, we were talking about a guy by the name of Clint H. I think Joe helped him. He talked about a prayer, and it's... His prayer was the closest thing, I think, that I guess my prayer of desperation was in that jail cell. It was like, God, come. Come now. Don't even send your son, because this is no place for children. You know what? And that prayer I identified with. That was intense, you know? That's an intense prayer. And I saw that. And it was sort of that way. And strangely enough, my wife, who was 20 years in Al-Anon, was off to a meeting that day, or that night, and a woman showed up in that meeting and provided her with a telephone number. And my wife didn't want to hear, the way the story goes, my wife didn't want to hear anything about this. She was done. She was leaving. She was taking the kids, going to Florida. She was done. And rightfully so, with me, because she put it up with enough, okay, and so did my children, and so did anyone that had any type of relationship with a guy like me at that time. She ended up taking that telephone number, and the woman said to her, "says, give this number to Tom, tell him to call this man, he can help him." This woman was a double winner. She was in AA and Al-Anon. And she just got finished going through the steps as it's outlined in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and had a spiritual awakening as a result of that. And my wife, the judge heard, I went before the judge. The judge cut me a break. He heard I had time separated from alcohol or a long time. Look to my wife, what do you want to do with this guy? Says, well, I need food. You know. I was always a functioning drunk, but not for that reason, you know. Not for food in the home. So I can get my booze. That's the important thing. The end result of that was that The judge let me go. He put me on 1 year probation. He told me to go 1 year of outpatient alcoholism on Staten Island. And my wife drove me home that day, that morning. And my two children were in the back seat. And I'll never forget that day. I shut up the house. I was pretty exhausted. They had me all over the city in different precincts, different jails, different Brooklyn House of Detention, all over the place that long weekend. And I was tired. But Ginny threw that telephone number at me. Literally threw the telephone number at me. And I'm on the mic, so I'm not going to say what she said. But basically she said, you know, I don't care really what you do, but I understand this man can help you. You know, I never asked for help in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hardest thing I think for a drunk to do is to ask for help until he gets to that place. You know? And I was at that place, and I picked up the telephone, and I made the call, and this man made we resonated, and we were at I knew he was the real deal. He was just like me. But he wasn't anymore. And I knew that. And I didn't even know the man. He made me a few promises on that phone. He told me things like, "Tom, you never have to drink alcohol again, ever. Okay? The way you're feeling right now, the way you've been feeling for a while now, you never have to feel that way ever again if you don't want to. If you're willing to follow some simple rules, you can experience some happiness, some joy, and some freedom in your life." And the last thing, he says, if you continue to do these things that I'm going to show you, if you're willing to go to any length, okay, I promise you the best days of your life lay ahead of you. The best days of your life. Now, I don't know why, okay, but in my bones, I knew that this man was telling me the truth. I just knew it, you know. And I think I had the same experience that Bill Wilson had when Evie was sharing with him. Okay. And the following week, I showed up at his place. Within that week, I suffered from the obsession to drink alcohol for the last time on October the 19th, 1994. And I was about to take myself off this planet on that very night. And I went to the phone again and I asked this man for some help. And he gave me the doctor's opinion, you know. And he asked me to do some exercise with that. And I remember being in a hotel room down in Richmond, Virginia. I was on a business trip. And I remember doing what he asked me to do. He gave me the lay aside prayer. Okay. He gave me, you know, like what to do with the doctor's opinion. And I did that. And I got back on my knees and I said that lay aside prayer twice that night. And I got into my bed and something came over me and I knew, I just knew it was going to be okay. Okay. I showed up at that man's house and he invited me into his home when no one would invite me anywhere. Okay. And he shared. He shared with me and he took me on a journey, okay, with him. Okay. And we went through and it was it's never been the same. It's never been the same. I've never looked back. Okay. So what I do today is what this man did for me, you know. I help a lot of drunks. I invite people into my home. I don't care if they're Al-Anons, AAs. My wife, Jenny saw that something strange came over me after about a year and a half or so. And I saw her walking down the steps of our home with a big book in her arms. And I looked at her kind of funny and I asked her the question. I said, "Where are you going?" She says, "Tom," says, "I know there's something in this." Okay. So she went out and got someone in Al-Anon to take her through the steps, through the big book Alcoholics Anonymous in Al-Anon. So she's working with a bunch of drunks people that suffer from untreated Al-Anonism, I guess you can call it. And that's what we do. And our life is full today. And sobriety isn't pain-free. You know, I've been on, you know, a beautiful road, you know, and it's still a beautiful road, you know. But my boy, I've had to write some inventory as of late. I was sharing with Einar, and I shared it with Peter a few weeks back. You know, my boy, you know, like he's a diabetic. He suffers right now from his disease. Went into something called diabetic retinopathy, which is the bleeding behind the eyes. And thank God we live in the age that we live in, because he's having laser technology treatments, you know. And God willing, without it, he could be blind, you know. And he's a 25-year-old boy today, you know. And my children walked down the aisle with my daughter last year. This is the same girl that was cried. You know, would be in hysterical when her father was taken away in handcuffs. Yeah, and you can't miss this. All you got to do is do the deal. You know, one day at a time. Thank you. Thank you.